Welcome to the Guffman. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is the most famous barrister I know, James. We've most recently discussed Rosemary's Baby. Before that was The Lost City of Zed. Before that was Point Blank and The Limey. And you can check those out on our website, themcguffman.com. I've also written a couple things about Diablo Cody and Tamara Jenkins recently. You can read those at the same place. And yeah, theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
James.
Uh-huh.
Talking about a bit of a lighter movie this week. What are we talking about?
Yeah, I didn't realize the how relatively light it was compared to what we've been talking about lately.
Yeah, exactly.
Lost City of Zed, like, they took the foot off the gas to go to World War One and choke on mustard gas.
Yeah, exactly. And then somehow we were like, hey, let's make this way more depressing and talk about Rosemary's Baby.
Yes, but then we chose a movie made in between those movies being made.
Yes. In that almost 50-year gap between those two movies.
But then to the way more fun end of the spectrum.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
1988's A Fish Called Wanda.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Had you seen this movie before?
I had not. Had you?
Yeah, long, long, long time ago. Okay. I remembered almost nothing about it.
Okay. Yeah, because this was one of your contributions to our list of topics. And I knew it had a reputation. And I knew members of my family liked it a lot when it was out, but I was two, so I didn't see it.
So. Yeah, this is my contribution to the list and my father's contribution to teaching a six-year-old about human sexuality. A very confusing comedic way.
That sounds in line with the Mr. James that I know.
Okay, then you smell her boot a lot, and then what's the next thing you do?
But
we're talking about A Fish Called Wanda. Mm-hmm. As we've kind of pointed to, it's just a lot sillier of a movie than we've been into lately. It's John Cleese is one of the stars and the co-writer and co-director.
Mm-hmm.
Along with Charles Crichton. He seems to really downplay his role in his directing duties. Do you buy that? Or
yes, kind of. I think it's my understanding is that Charles Crichton was quite old when they were actually directing this movie. I think it was 78. And it seems like Crichton and Cleese were just like, they just got along really well and were good friends. So like it would never really seem like a power struggle on set if somebody was like, hey, why don't we do this or vice versa. John Cleese has said that like he hadn't directed a feature in so long that he didn't feel entirely comfortable like taking full directing duties. But also the studio wasn't comfortable with a 78-year-old man taking full directing duties. So John Cleese said he would step in whenever need be. Is my understanding of the situation.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. And I think, as you said, John Cleese and Charles Crichton, I think were just good friends who would speak well of each other. And maybe Cleese did do more than he's letting on and is just being nice about it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think you're right that it comes down to they probably had some of the same sensibilities and would come to a compromise about anything they did disagree about.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, as you said, I mean, Charles Crichton hadn't directed a movie in a long time, like 20-something years before this. And even in 88, I mean, Charles Crichton has credits in the 30s. So,
yeah.
Like, in the 1930s. So, even at that point in the late 80s, Crichton's career is close. Like, has the beginning of Crichton's career is closer to the invention of cinema than it is to like the contemporary production of this movie,
yeah.
Which is incredible. And so I, as I've been saying, we can't really split it perfectly about who did what, but I enjoy this movie, and this movie made a good amount of money for the kind of movie that it is and the budget that it had. So, and it was critically well received. So whoever did it did a good job of it, in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I enjoy it. I mean, I can't say I was super excited about it after having watched it. But this is also the type of movie that just, when I'm watching it alone in my room on a Monday afternoon, that's not really the best scenario for it. I'm certain I would have enjoyed it a lot more had I been able to see it in a theater in 1988, you know?
Yeah.
It just plays plays like something that would be a lot more fun with other people.
What is it about it that makes you say that?
Well,
beyond it just a comedy? It's a certain kind of comedy?
Yeah, it's a comedy, and also there's sort of this there's a pace to a lot of scenes that I think can get escalated in the audience just by being around enough people that laugh at different points than maybe you would. Like there are certain, certainly the best scene in this movie to me is when Archie and Wanda are at Wanda's house, or sorry, at Archie's house, and Archie's wife comes back unbeknownst to Archie. That whole sequence is like the sequence that easily made me laugh the hardest in this movie. Something about that sort of setup would just always make me laugh, that somebody expecting to see somebody else in a room and then being confused as to where those other people went. It just gives you a lot to play with, like physically and also with reactions and also comedically. It also features my favorite line in the movie, which is when Archie's wife repeats Kevin Kline's CIA name, which is hysterical. But
it's so funny to me.
It's fantastic. It's 10 stars out of 5.
And it quickly, just a movie that goes for, you know, a lot of, it's not as though it's all super broad and super dumb comedy, but you know, a lot of this stuff I would have found funny when I was 6, right?
Oh yeah, so for sure.
It's not all, I mean, there are some kind of subtle cultural things that I do appreciate about it, but it is kind of big and zany and wacky in a lot of ways, and that is such a downplayed line. You know, she just kind of blows through it with some nice, you know, doing her best to believe that that's his name and saying it as best, like so much better than he said it.
Yeah.
Just a nice British accent. It's such a quick, small, downbeat joke that absolutely killed me. But
yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. Because the zaniness of that joke has already been milked by Kevin Kline as he's actually coming up with the name. And then she's just like, well, he said that's his name. So that's just, I'm going to say it like anybody's name. But yeah, that sequence is a good example of something where even something that maybe wouldn't have made me laugh out loud watching it by myself, being around other people that chuckle at something and then somebody chuckles at something else. And that just sort of has an effect on the whole crowd. And then eventually you just start finding something funnier than you would by yourself, just because you enjoy the experience of watching this comedy with other people. And I mean, that's why the vast majority of my favorite experiences in a movie theater have come while watching comedies, because it's that sort of shared experience that I appreciate about going to the movies, and it's the most easy to, or it's the easiest to get out of comedies. And I guess horror movies, I just don't see as many horror movies because it's not as much in my wheelhouse. But yeah, that's just something that this movie, I mean, just in the process of how I watched it, this movie had going against it, you know?
Yeah. And I think in that scene in particular, which probably would be the best sequence, front to back, I think I would agree with you on that. Mm-hmm. The kind of humor that is involved in that, I think, tracks perfectly with the theater experience that you're describing, because it's not like a pie to the face. It's not a certain type of humor. It's this very social humor, right? Like, you're uncomfortable because you know Archie's uncomfortable, and everyone's like having to act a certain way socially and just can't be candid and can't be themselves and react naturally in that situation. People are stifling emotions and questions, and that is the kind of thing that can really get a group of people going, because now you're in the social situation with all these other people and they feel uncomfortable about it. And you know, it's that thing where when you can't laugh, sometimes you laugh the hardest, right? Be like when you're not allowed to. And I think that scene, I mean, that kind of humor is throughout this movie, but I think it's really dense in that scene, because there's people hidden and there's relationships being hidden and, you know, identities being concealed. And I just think that really plays to that kind of group situation, like that social setting coming from that socially based kind of humor.
Yep, absolutely.
And that, I mean, the other thing that I think that scene sums up really well is a lot of what this movie is. I mean, if you wanted to describe the plot of this movie pretty quickly, it's, you know, some criminals get mixed up and they complete a robbery and then kind of fight each other through various means to get the diamonds for themselves or whatever,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But just because of the way everyone's relationships bounces off each other and people know certain things, like, it would be a pretty complicated diagram to explain all the mechanics of this plot and who knows what when and where people are hiding and where the key is and where the diamond is and you know, who Wanda's kissing in this scene or whatever, right? Like, there just is a lot happening in this movie. You know, there's just to write down every plot point about how things change and who's trying to scheme what. There's just a lot of information there. Kind of the way we talked about with Seinfeld, like a lot of things happen in an episode of Seinfeld.
Yeah.
A lot of things happen in A Fish Called Wanda, even though you generally get the idea pretty briefly. But that is very true of this scene as well. Like, Wanda's behind the door now, and now she's behind under the couch, and now Otto's hidden in front of that front door, and then he comes up the stairs, and then he leaves the room. Like, they're just from a very X's and O standpoint, there's a ton happening in that scene, and a lot to keep track of, and a lot of stuff to keep your eye on, and process about how people are treating each other in this situation for all those various reasons, and that spans this whole movie. And so I think that scene sums up this movie well and does a good job of condensing some of its best bits into it, right? And it's, you know, kind of central to the whole film as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what you're saying about this, they're all always being, you know, like different characters have different levels of information. But the audience is always, it's always very clear to the audience what is happening, who knows what. And it's not really like a lot of mystery movies where the audience is kept in the dark about something for a twist at the end. You know, pretty much after we see Wanda in the scene where they go back to the safe and we see Wanda pull out something to hit Otto in the head with, it's not like there's any really new sort of twist to this movie, and that's like the 15-minute mark. You know what I mean? After that, yeah, it's all playing with information that we know all the information as the viewer, and then depending on which piece of information it is, different characters know what it is. Or like Wanda knows where the key is, but Ken doesn't know that Wanda knows where the key is. That sort of thing. But we know both of those things, you know. And yeah, I think using Seinfeld as a comparison is a good point because, as you said, there's lots of information in Seinfeld and there's lots of information in this, but it's always easy to follow information. So everybody can follow this movie, and it also, that there is so much information, it keeps everybody mentally engaged, which allows you to find a movie funnier because just in general, I think as a general rule, I think it's good to treat your audience like they're intelligent because then the rewards are just stronger. And I think that's something that this movie does really well is give you the information it's giving you helps keep you involved and makes the comedy funnier because you're involved in the movie. Yeah,
you're not playing keep up. I hadn't really considered that. I was thinking about that when you were talking. Like, I think maybe when we learn Otto and Wanda aren't actually brother and sister is one of the few reveals that a time when a character knows something and then the audience gets let in on it. But again, that's
before what I was talking about. Even, you know?
Yeah. And I can't think of any other examples like that. So it really is. It really is all this information being put out there. And then you kind of just watching these characters bounce off each other and pretty quickly you get the sense that it's kind of every man for himself or every woman for themselves. And I mean, I guess it's not even a reveal. The change comes when Archie and Wanda want, you know, can be happy with each other, or I guess more so that Wanda's willing to be with Archie despite him not being very rich. But we learn that kind of as quickly as she does. And I think that's a sweeter moment of this movie. And I think that I don't think this movie tries to do a lot emotionally. I think it tries to do about 2.5 things and gets them all right.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, this movie doesn't leave me with this crazy warm feeling in my heart or anything, but I think it just tries to put a bit of a sentimental button on it. And I think that easily could have been overshot and missed. And I just think that it's so minor that it, you know, with a low degree of difficulty, it pulls it off perfectly.
Okay. Yeah, that's fair. I mean, this movie does have the one of my least favorite tropes in comedy history. I mean, this happens in dramas as well, where characters have just met, and then two scenes later, one of them's telling the other that they love them. And I'm just like, well, I guess, you know, I guess they do, because the movie told me that this is the case. But yeah, I mean, as you said, that's not. I'm certain John Cleese is already upset that I'm focusing on that scene. You know.
So you mean Wanda and Archie?
Yeah, when they're just talking to each other, and he says, probably about halfway through the movie, I think it's in that apartment where he ends up being caught naked by that family, where he confesses his love to her, and they've known each other for like 2 days and spent a total of 40 minutes together, probably, you know, most of which has been in the midst of zany hijinks.
Yeah, I mean, that might be stupid guys and pretty girls, but I want to know what you thought about Mrs. Leach, about Wendy, who we touched on briefly with her what I assume is a perfect pronunciation of Manfred's engines or whatever that was.
Yeah, I mean, I think she's fantastic. I mean, of all, you know, there's the four characters that have a lot to do, and then her and George Thomason don't have a lot, but get, I think, are just fantastic in much smaller roles. And I think her especially, there's something about her, especially in her first scene of their interaction with Archie, just the way she's talking about how she hasn't had a moment to herself for the whole day. Cleese's reaction when he says, oh no, when she's like explaining her day to him. I think their interactions just are very enjoyable, and I think she's fantastic in this movie.
And
so much so that I'm going to say her name, which is Maria Aitken.
Okay.
Yeah.
So speaking about the kind of more serious relationship aspects of this very silly movie, how do you feel about her treatment? I mean, in the end, she kind of gets left, and we don't see a ton of their time together, but that she gets left behind when mm-hmm. Archie leaves with Wanda.
I mean, I guess like this movie is so zany that I guess I didn't really think about the human aspect of things, because there's nothing about this movie reminds me of reality, you know, at least in the way that things happen, you know, the physical world looks like the physical world I understand, you know.
Safes hanging above doorways with a piece of wood stopping them.
Yeah, I mean, but like, yeah, but like Archie runs away from his entire life, you know. It's not like he doesn't say goodbye to his daughter. It's not so much that I mean, he just walks out of a courtroom and goes to the airport, basically. After, and also witnesses somebody get literally steamrolled, and then it's just like, cool, that's fine, moving on. I don't know, like if we start talking about these people as if they're actual humans, like they are just borderline emotionless humans except for the few moments when they're confessing their love to each other, you know. And because to go through all of the things Archie goes through in this movie and then just get on a plane like everything's okay, you just have to be like so emotionally closed off, you know? So I just have a hard time thinking about the human aspect of this movie just because of, I suppose calling it inhuman just seems too pejorative, but maybe just how self-centered all of the characters are, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that's true. But you called Archie kind of closed off, and that's why you have a hard time thinking about that, you know, that question I posed, or that sort of aspect of this movie. Mm-hmm. Do you think that that is a symptom of, you know, a very zany movie, or is that something about what John Cleese wants to say about British society, something that gets spelled out pretty clearly at times throughout this movie, but mm-hmm. also has some subtler notes to it as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's like the one thing I did like about this movie, the way this movie discusses intelligence and the perception of intelligence as well. You get a lot of that with Otto. Did you just gasp?
I swooned.
Okay, fair enough. But yeah, I that's the one thing about this movie that outside of the comedic and trickery side of things, that I found myself, like, as somebody who has committed to talking about this movie for up to an hour with one of my closest friends, like, you have to think about these movies differently than just going to see a comedy at the movie theater. And that was the one thing that I could find that I actually liked, that jumped out at me as something worth thinking about, because I do find the way intelligence is perceived by Americans and the way intelligence is perceived by British and Canadian, in our case, people, to be very interesting. And I also just very much enjoyed the Otto saying apes don't read philosophy and Wanda's response, they just don't understand it. Like all of those sequences I found very interesting and not even very interesting, but just sort of like nice moments to put into a movie that just sort of functions as primarily a comedy where nothing really of weight is discussed in any way, but at least there's something going on that I can think about outside of the hijinks. Yeah,
it's at least you could have some idea of how these people would speak about subjects with weight.
Yeah.
And Archie's might be a bit more well-informed and nuanced than Otto.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think the comparison between the British and American stuff, I think, is so central to this movie. Mm-hmm. And as I said, sometimes it's spelled out pretty explicitly, but I think that's kind of the one layer deeper that is still pretty easy to access that makes this movie just a bit more dynamic and fleshed out than in a lot of kind of zany crime capers that would look pretty similar.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are a couple scenes where Otto and Archie and Wanda and Wendy are paired as like they're intercut. The scene where we see Archie and Wendy in their two separate beds in their bedroom is intercut with Otto and Wanda having sex. And just the idea that this classically intelligent, I mean, he's a lawyer. He's one of the most classical kind of intelligent jobs possible, or that, you know, that we think about. Otto is a criminal and he's partaking in something physical, whereas Archie is just sitting in his separate bed looking over the case. And I feel like there's one other example of their lives being intercut between each other. And it's just supposed to be to show that, you know, the difference their lifestyles have given them, you know, like Otto has a more exciting lifestyle and Archie has a more comfortable, safe lifestyle, you know, but he's a little bored in it. And Otto's lifestyle ends up, again, he gets literally steamrolled, you know, like it's, there are pluses and minuses to both sides of the coin. But the idea is at the end of the movie, at least, is that one person from one side comes together with one person from the other side and then they start a leper colony together.
Yeah, I think that takeaway, I mean, the takeaway for me there is that, this movie says things about American society and American intelligence and uses American humor and also says things about British intelligence, British society, and British humor. And, you know, John Cleese and a lot of people involved in this are British and, you know, very open and somewhat proud of that fact. And yeah, I mean, by the end, we have one from each side coming together. And so to me, that's just saying, you know, for all the fun we've poked at both of these societies, the best answer is probably somewhere in the middle. It's like, yeah, it's some synthesis of these two that you shouldn't be as overly confident as Otto is. Yeah. You shouldn't be as like quiet and repressed as Archie is. And a good juxtaposition between those two is that when they're fooling around with Wanda and she likes to hear people talk in foreign languages, Otto is just saying like different cheeses he can think of in Italian, whereas Archie is quoting Russian poetry.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they're both, kind of performing this thing for her, and it seems to work. But Archie's is done with knowledge and history and, based on something he learned and probably finds meaning in. And that's why he still has it memorized after all these years. And Otto's is really just, saying the right noises, making the right sounds, and to be completely superficial like that. And that superficiality is something that gets talked about, explicitly in this movie, and is also played with in a bunch of ways.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I mean, Otto will read Nietzsche, but he will fall asleep to it.
Yeah, exactly. And then he'll wake up and fire a gun at a wall.
Yeah, I mean, and just that itself, it's that, the issue of firearms, obviously, if we look at American and British society, we know which one is a bigger fan.
Yeah.
And we see Otto wake up, shoot something, kind of be confused about it for a second, and then just sort of smiles to himself as though he's done the right thing. Mm-hmm. And that that propensity to violence is something that is clearly aligned with American culture in this movie.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Also, one of the things I feel like, this is a comedy from the 1980s, so there are homophobic moments in this movie, but I also feel like the only homophobia in the movie is attributed to Otto, which is a decision that I may or may not have been intentional, but I think is enjoyable over time, because he's the villain. If anybody is the villain of this movie, it's him, and not everything about him is vilified, but his more outrageous things seem to be, his more outrageous tendencies seem to be. And I mean, of all the instances of homophobia in a 1980s comedy, this is the one where I was the most like, oh, it's actually got some sort of meaning to it,
Yeah. Yeah, I actually, in my notes, I literally had the question, is Otto a villain, or is he the villain, or none of the above?
Yeah, there is no the villain. They might all be villains,
Yeah, I kind of chalk it up to the you can't cheat an honest man kind of thing. Like, all of these people are getting duped, but they only put themselves in this position by robbing a bank and trying to dupe each other, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's no one you can point to in this movie other than the people at the bank who are innocent victims, and we spend no time with them. We just watch these people, kind of crab in a bucket, step on each other to get above each other. So,
yes.
Yeah, I don't think that there is a villain here. I mean, I think we're meant to like Archie the most, I guess, but yeah. Even he has some questionable stuff.
I think we're meant to like Wanda the most, if anybody.
I mean, I think she and Otto are the most deceptive of anybody in this movie.
Unquestionably.
So why do you think we're meant to stick with Wanda? Because she has a happy ending? She grows?
She has a happy ending. She's played by Jamie Lee Curtis, who nobody seems to dislike. And her name is in the title. I don't know. Archie doesn't seem central enough at the beginning. He is sort of an instrument of other people for the first half of this movie. And I can see the perspective that, it's like the audience being pulled into something that that they didn't realize they were going to be a part of. But I just feel like most audiences would want to identify with somebody earlier than that and would want to view themselves as somebody in more of a powerful position than Archie is in for the first half of the movie. So I feel like if we were to go back to 1988 and stand outside of a movie theater and poll people on the way out, I feel most people would be attached to Wanda more than any other character.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think that, yeah, it's tough with Otto because I think he's the most fun. I mean, this has taken a long time, but awesome performance. I mean, other people have said this about Kevin Kline's performance as Otto. I find it hilarious. It's totally up my alley, so this shouldn't shock anybody either. But yeah, I mean, he has like just some great delivery and obviously a ton of confidence and charisma and some really great physical stuff, really great physical comedy. That's always going to go far with me. Mm-hmm. Did you feel he lives up to the hype or?
I want to say no, but I also want to make it very clear that I am a Kevin Kline fan in general. There are certain moments of this movie that are just so like an element of over the top, like theatrical sort of over the top that sometimes can just go a little bit too far for me. And I can be impressed by it, but it doesn't make me laugh. The sex scene, I remember like full Liz Lemon eye roll, you know, like I was just so done with it.
You mean the hottest O face in the history of cinema?
Yeah, exactly. O face jokes in general, just I suppose do not work for me. Yeah, just those sort of performative aspects, and like I get it, like you, unbelievably talented. Kevin Kline's fantastic, but sometimes there's just more Kevin Kline than I need, you know?
Yeah, no, for me, like the highest in this movie is not the biggest, like that.
Exactly.
The O-face stuff is not like my takeaways with him.
Yeah, the stuff like the one moment that I can point to off the top of my head that I was just like specifically this is fantastic and only Kevin Kline could do this is when they open the safe and they realize that George has taken everything out of it unbeknownst to them. And he just responds by yelling disappointed and gets up, like kicks the car, says something like, son of a bitch, what do you have to do in this life to make people trust you? And that delivery, that like mini dance that he does, the rage dance or whatever, like that's the Kevin Kline that I love, where it's like too theatrical for any movie based in logic, but not so theatrical that I'm rolling my eyes, you know? And that's the element of his performance that I think is fantastic.
Yeah, no, that is kind of one of the bigger ones. I mean, he does like do some weird dance and jump and like kick and punch a car at the same time in a weird like dancey way. And I mean, just in general, I think that he does something that a lot of really good male physical comedians do, which is like act really feminine in the way that they move their body a lot. Mm-hmm. And not in like a condescending, like I'm trying to play this down kind of thing, but just has a certain way of moving that he does have throughout this movie. And yeah, things like when he says you've got wonderful bones, great eyes, and you dress really interesting. Like it's not a big, loud one. But I think the delivery is absolutely perfect. Mm-hmm. And when he says you're the Vulgarian, you fuck, like obviously there's something inherently goofy in that because it's such a contradiction, but, that could be delivered with less success by most people and things like that, that he just handles so easily, I think is the testament to him in this one.
Yeah. Yep. I can agree with that.
But why I brought that up and on the subject of Otto and, the homophobia that you mentioned that, you know, I think I also agree is handled as well as you can handle it.
Again, which may or may not have been intentional. Let's be clear.
That's true. The way that he spies on Wanda as well, you know, it kind of brought up the American-British comparison again to me because we think of Britain as very repressed and it's, you know, explicitly stated as such in this one. But in Europe in general, I think we think of sexuality as something that's just much freer and something that people are more secure about. And in this one, we have Otto, like, he can't let this woman out of his sight. And part of their whole scheme is for her to seduce all these people. But he seems to have the sexual insecurity that he needs to, like, look through the window or sneak into the house to make sure that that nothing is happening. And I think that and this might be a bit ahead of its time, but that constant surveillance and that world policing and that sexual insecurity, I think, is something that gets chalked up to the American psyche much more than the European one.
Yep, for sure.
And all the times that he says, "Don't call me stupid." Like, yes. I love the role of the stupid con man. Like, I love the role of the con man. So yeah. The notion of this character who is a confidence man who has no reason to be so confident is right on for me.
Yeah, I would agree. Let's see. What else? Oh, we got to talk about Michael Palin, because all of those dogs dying is after Wendy saying the CIA name again. The scenes with the dogs dying are easily my second favorite part of this movie. They are so funny.
I couldn't decide, because sometimes you hate those, like, big spectacle gags, but I know you love the idea of animals dying.
This is more like the spectacle gag works, and it's so removed from everything. Like, I mean we've talked about this with Quentin Tarantino movies, how I love when a movie will just have, like, a sketch in the middle of it that is, like, so barely connected to what else is happening. Like, I know it's important they're trying to kill the witness without it seeming like a murder, but man, those are funny. And it's mostly
prominent use of the number 69,
also hilarious. John Cleese is a genius. And just, like, it's mostly silent, you know, and it's every cut to a grave is so funny. Yeah. Both times they do it is great. And when they cut to George saying "fucking unbelievable" after he actually does it the third time, it's so funny, you know? Yeah. And I just think
the cuts to the grave and the cuts to George is just a nice, cute little bit of editing. Like, if they're going to do one, you don't expect two. But if they're going to do two, you expect three. And they just pull the rug out from under you, so... That's just a nice little filmmaking thing that gets a good laugh.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're just, like, you know, they're just removed enough from the movie to make it feel so out of step with everything else, because there's very little that's that big physically in the movie outside of, you know, with the other characters' plot lines, outside of Archie being held outside the window, a la Suge Knight and Vanilla Ice.
There's another reveal that he was upside down the whole time.
Yeah, exactly. I heard that's where the Dark Knight got the idea for the Joker at the end. Yeah, like, outside of that, there's nothing, like, big and physical in the other three characters' stories. So it's just an interesting sort of tonal change for, like, a minute at a time, three different times in this movie, and I think that's cool. And it works.
Yeah.
It just works. Like, you're right that is something that I could easily see as not working, but I think it works better than almost anything else in the movie.
Yeah, and the other big one that, I mean, you've talked about this, I'm not saying you missed it, but Otto's near death by steamroll. Yeah, I think that by that point, it's kind of winding down. You know, we're starting to see Archie and Wanda as a bit more like people. Like, I will reiterate that this movie did not, like, touch me deeply. The the humanity of them was just overwhelming at this point. But it seems to try to bring it home at the end with a bit of humanity. And that just leaves Otto out in the cold. Like, this American caricature, it's so big and broad, and... It's such a cartoon that it has to come to some cartoony death like that, right? Like, him yelling, you know, just being arrogant about maybe winning Vietnam and getting stuck in cement and literally being run over by a steamroller. Like, there's something about this movie being so zany for so long and then grounding itself that Otto has to be, he has to go to the other end of the spectrum and get the complete cartoon treatment.
Yeah, exactly. And another Kevin Kline moment that I love. I believe he yells fuck as he's getting steamrolled. And the way he yells that is just, again, only Kevin Kline could pull it off. You know, it's great.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Yeah. What do you, I don't have a solid thought on this. It's just something that jumps out at me and throughout this movie.
Why are the British security system so good?
No.
The honor system that British airport security ran on in the late 80s.
Exactly. No, if you flip the gun, it's okay.
Yeah. And in the court too, when he passes the note and then like there's that whole chaos scene in the courthouse anyway. Okay, sorry, what was your real question?
No, just about Wanda's motivations and the level of agency she may or may not have throughout this movie, because naturally that's something I think of when the only female main character kisses literally everybody in the movie. I'm just going to sort of be like...
Every lead character in the movie.
No, literally everybody. There were deleted scenes. Lots of deleted scenes. She was at every dog funeral kissing those dogs goodbye.
Right.
No, I'm just curious to know, like... Just because I still don't have an answer for whether or not Wanda seems to have any agency at the end of the movie. Like, it kind of just feels like she... is like Archie's here, so sure, let's go together now, you know? Like, I don't really feel like she ever commits to any, I don't know, actually being authentically interested in any of these characters, and I think I feel like she's a real question mark at the end of the movie, and I'm just curious what you think about her, you know?
Yeah, I mean a few things there. I think the way that it's obviously her kissing all these people, it's to get by, right? Like, it's part of the plan to seduce people and earn their trust to find out information.
And also this, I mean, I know we're talking about a 30-year-old movie, so calling this movie old fashioned is like obviously true, but for 1988, this movie is old fashioned, you know? Like, it's a very 50s sort of, it's clearly got elements of a film noir that they're not playing with too much because it's more of a comedy. It's sort of halfway between like a zany comedy from the 50s and a film noir, you know? And as such, some of the characterizations are old fashioned. And I think Wanda is absolutely a perfect example of that. You know, she feels like a character out of the 50s to me.
Yeah, no. I think you're right. And I think that's part of why Charles Crichton was there. He's made movies like this, and so let's bring that sensibility to this picture. Mm-hmm. I think that part of it might be that that British sensibility of being so repressed and not being able to deal with sexuality, that the fact that she's able to use it as a tool and as a weapon without getting caught up emotionally might in a way be attractive to Archie, or might try to win over the viewer as well. Okay. That there's just a certain level of cunning, and that there's a certain level of confidence one needs in order to function in that manner.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that's particularly telling, I mean, we look at Archie as a barrister, and, you know, on the subject of British repression and stuffiness, look what he wears to work. Like, look at his workplace and how he dresses at work, right? Like, I can't think of anything more kind of high-minded and antiquated than those white powdered wigs, right?
Yeah.
And, I mean, for reasons that are separate from the cultural thing I'm talking about, he calls Wanda darling and, deposing her at some point in this trial, and that lets it be known that they have some kind of relationship and that he's been acting in a manner that's untoward for a barrister, and, you know, plot dominoes fall as a result. But I think it's really telling that in this examination of British stuffiness, like, the worst thing he can do is say this term of affection about a woman in public.
Yeah.
Like, and again, it has plot reasons that add up 1,000%, but I just do appreciate how, kind of emblematic that is of so many of the things that they're talking about. And yeah, I mean, that's a roundabout way to answer your question about Wanda. I think that she kind of finds the opposite of who she is in Archie a little bit. Mm-hmm. And that explains a lot of the attraction there. Now, maybe she's been surrounding herself with people like Otto and the wrong type of people for such a long time that to find anybody with some normalcy like Archie has seems instantly attractive. And maybe 2 weeks into the leper colonies, she'll realize that they're not actually that compatible. But
I mean, they had 17 children. Just doing the math, she was there more than 2 weeks.
More than 2 weeks. Yeah, but I also think it's telling that they moved to another country, and again, that makes sense for plot reasons. But that there's neither the British nor American systems or cultures are perfect, and that there's some third way in where they hope to find happiness.
Okay, so thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Man, and check back next week.